So I'll be talking about, updates on the GOLD 2017 and what would really make a change in our clinical practice. So not to change really from the common grounds, when we meet patients in our clinics, the first thing we look at their symptoms, we ask about how things are happening, and there are some alarming signs that we look for: shortness of breath, chronic cough, sputum. Then we move to more assessing them and looking, for risk factors. And you look for mostly tobacco and occupational exposures. And that will kind of trigger the hint that this could be COPD you deal with. Now, unfortunately, in many scenarios, people stop at this level, call it COPD, and start therapy. This is where pulmonologists in general do not agree, and the guidelines, of course, are not supportive of that. And they do require really having a spirometry to confirm the obstruction and then confirm the diagnosis. So it's not a clinical diagnosis without a spirometry. Having said so, I need to be clear about one fact, which is doing a spirometry is a tricky issue as well. You have to make sure you have the adequate technique and the quality control. A lot of times, some of our colleagues, general practitioners, or a family practitioner, they do have, the spirometer in their clinic. And if they do not have really a good quality control training or a technical support to do a good test, most of the time we end up with numbers which are, having a useless meaning. So when we talk about airflow limitation, we also have to classify it, and that's the basic, criteria looking at COPD, and we have them into four quartiles, and I'm sure we're all familiar with them. However, we all knew that over the years, we found out that, this differentiation in airflow limitation, and we've just been listening to Dr. Hanani about the phenotypes and the different type of patient, does not really tell us or prognosticate adequately how patient behave. And you may have two patients with the same FEV1, but with a very different outcome and prospect of the disease progression. That is why in 2004, there was this famous publication by Barcelli, which created the BODE index, where we integrated physiologic parameters for the first time as a one score for COPD patient in addition to the airflow obstruction. And not to the surprise of anybody, but in the same paper, there was this better differentiation even of prognosis using the quartiles of BODE compared to FEV1 alone. Having seen so, it was something that you expect that the coming GOLD afterwards will look at a more significant correlation and a more significant integration of physiologic parameters rather than just looking at, an obstruction. And I have to say that the GOLD evolved into three phases. In 2011, 2014, maybe a little bit of a minor effect, but it's also impressive, and 2017 now is what we're talking about. Now, what was the big change in 2011? There was the introduction of the ABCD, quartiles, and the differentiation of the patients based on risk factors such as exacerbation and the obstruction, and based on symptomatology. Now, though this was revolutionary, somehow it was arbitrary. This plotting of data was done, which was the most meaningful at the time and the most making sense, awaiting to see how this will translate into the clinical practice and the follow-up, and then reanalyze and reshaping it later on. And just as a cap, we know that these are the tools used, mostly the MMRC and the CAT score, which are all about looking at symptomatology and how much it's affecting our patients. Again, in 2014, there was another landmark in the progress, which is the AECOS. This is the first time they recognized an entity, despite now that it's not a syndrome anymore. We're going to discuss it a little bit in the 2017 update. But at the time, it was the first time this was recognized as an issue. All of us dealt with patients with COPD in the clinic. You do bronchodilation challenge, and they do respond. They were asthmatics in the young age. They developed COPD after a long history of smoking, and you know where to characterize them. And that was something important. At the time, that made sense because we all remember, the Dutch hypothesis, which came out in the 60s, that the obstructive lung disease has usually two ends of the spectra. You have the COPD at one end, which is, the irreversible or partially reversible, versus the asthma, which is the completely reversible at the other end. And then in between, you have a spectrum of patients. And the ACOS would fall somewhere in the middle. That was the thinking at the time, at least. One really awkward situation we found ourselves in, that how to look at the studies, how to analyze these patients, because it was always a mutual exclusion. If you look at the COPD data, if patients have bronchoreversibility, they were excluded most of the time. If you look at asthmatic data, patients who are, you know, a smoker were excluded to being subjects. So we fell in the penumbra, and we couldn't really evaluate these patients adequately. Now we're going to finish with the old gold, you know, updates and go to the new one, the 2017 update, which is really the focus of what we're going to be discussing today. In my opinion, there was four impressive changes. First, there was the refinement of the assessment scheme, or which I personally call the remapping of the diagnostic classes. We have the therapy strategy, changes in the approach. If you change the diagnostic approach, you would definitely be changing the therapeutics. The ACO without an S now. And there was the first time, as we heard yesterday from Dr. Osmani, there was the first time a focus and really concentration on the fact that we have to take a bigger look at the inhaler and at devices per se and assess for the use of these devices. So I'll start first with the refinement of the scheme. So now this was broken down into two pieces. Instead of looking at ABCD, and in the same way including the obstruction in it, the obstruction was taken out first. So you would be first classifying the patient. You'd be first classifying the patients as how bad the obstruction is, depending on the gold, old criteria, the four quartiles. And then you would do the ABCD using the risk factor as only exacerbation now and not the obstruction. So with that, you will end up for the same patient with two pieces of information. You'll have a number, a gold 3, for example, and the letter class D or class B. Now, how do you look at that? Usually when you evolve, you try to simplify things. That looks a bit more complex at this level. So looking at numbers and letters, how do we analyze that? Yeah, the first, the number, which is the spirometric obstruction, grading 1 through 4, which usually is going to be the biggest tool for the non-pharmacologic approach, looking at, you know, a candidate for lung volume reduction surgery, for lung transplant, for prognostication and survival. And then you would have the groups with the letter used, the A through D, which is mostly going to be our guide for pharmacotherapy mostly. Now, moving to pharmacotherapy, which a lot of people know this is not my favorite subject to discuss on the podium, we have reshaped the treatments. And exactly as Dr. Hanania was saying, there was some moving around with the priorities of treatment. However, we can notice two major dogmatic changes. One, again, as previously mentioned, we have more concentrated LAMA-LABA at several steps, recognizing the data that was published and solid enough, but it may have been requiring a little bit more reshaping before we commit ourselves to such, you know, of the LAMA-LABA indications. However, which is also very interesting here and very important to see, is that for the first time, you have these triangular changes. And this is for the first time whereby you will talk about actually de-escalation of treatment. You may go back and forth and you may de-escalate. And this is when we always heard about this, you know, in asthma management, you de-escalate after 3 months or you wait longer if the patient is, you know, borderline. But in COPD, never there was a mention of when to de-escalate therapy once you go up. ACO. Again, it is not a syndrome anymore. So asthmatics can develop COPD. COPD can have eosinophilic infiltration and different bronchoreversibility. So it's not a syndrome. It's an overlap of two entities, most likely. And this is why we have to look at this from different perspective now. And we know that even asthmatics have, you know, 12 times the higher risk of developing COPD because of this airway inflammation. At the same time, we know that 20% of asthmatics in longitudinal studies may develop some form of chronic fixed obstruction. So this is why ACO is no more a syndrome, but it's an entity by itself overlapping two existing diseases. Now, on the same level, I will move to talking about, you know, the inhaler and devices. Again, that has been a big scheme. We always told patients, and I repeat, mostly in the asthma workup and trials, that you do not up the treatment before you review how the inhalers are being used, if you know that the patient is able to acquire the doses the way they should. But in COPD, though we all believe we should do it, it was never illustrated so clearly like in the goal 2017. And now every patient who is on inhaler will need to educate them and will need to reassess frequently if they're adequately and capable of generating, for example, the negative pressure to get the DPI. Can they get the flow required? Are they able to coordinate? Most of our patients are elderly patients. They may not be able to deal with devices the way we want them to. So it's not enough to prescribe and then to up treatment later on. We have to have a more critical look on how patients do it. I'm not sure how it's done in different, you know, areas in the region. When you practice in the States, when I used to be in the state, I mean, we used to, you know, write the script, either your clinic nurse or the pharmacist will do the education. This doesn't happen in Lebanon, at least. Okay, the pharmacist does not do the education. Okay, the pharmacist barely does the dispensing. So if you do not provide the education in the clinic, and if you do not follow on that, nobody would. So it's very crucial, and we know that the outcome and the control of disease relates a lot to the technique and the acquisition of the dosing via the inhalers. There are issues also discussed yesterday by Dr. Osmani, but I'm just going to go over them quick. The tricks you have to look at, the inspiratory flow, the inhalation duration, the coordination, hand and mouth coordination, dose preparation, the exhalation maneuver prior to inhaling. So it is really a little bit tricky, but it will make the whole difference if you make sure your patient is getting what he gets. Now, after I talk about this, there are six elements that I cannot overlook, even if they are restated or a different way, which are oxygen therapy, the use of non-invasive support and non-invasive ventilation, rehabilitation, vaccinations, smoking cessation, and palliative care. So we'll go quickly over them. We know that in the 60s, there was this large, you know, Medicare study which showed that survival correlates with having adequate oxygenation, and this is where Medicare decided to cover long-term oxygen therapy. But then reanalyzing the data and looking at, you know, a large trial which was done in 2016 and published in the New England Journal of Medicine, we know that patients who have severe resting hypoxemia do benefit from long-term oxygen therapy at more than 15 hours a day. However, if a patient has, you know, mild to moderate hypoxia with exercise, they may not have a significant benefit. And when we say mild to moderate hypoxia, we mean that the saturation at rest is more than 88%, and the saturation with exercise is more than 80%, which will spontaneously go up after rest in 1 minute, and is not associated with other clinical syndromes such as core pulmonale or right heart failure. What about the use of non-invasive ventilation? We all know that in exacerbation and respiratory failure, this has a big role in the ICU setting or in the hospital setting. However, it was proven that chronic use of it at home in the setting of non-hypercarbic failure and non-recent hospitalization may not change outcome as well, except, of course, if patient has obstructive sleep apnea and they will benefit from a CPAP overnight. So having an exacerbation requiring non-invasive ventilation in the hospital setting but leaving with a normal carbia at home does not usually have an indication to be on long-term non-invasive ventilation in the home setting. Pulmonary rehabilitation. Now here, this is a very delicate issue, and I would like to clarify a few details. Pulmonary rehabilitation is not physical therapy. It's not sending them to get physical therapy and get exercise. It's really a comprehensive intervention, which includes exercise training, but also include education, self-management interventions, promoting long-term adherence to the strategies. So it's really a process. It's not just bringing to a physical therapist and training them. Most of the time, if the therapist is not really versed how to train, you know, pulmonary hypoxic or severely debilitated respiratory patient, this may be counterproductive. Optimum benefit was achieved with program from 6 to 8 weeks, having at least 2 observed training per week. Studies shown that going up to 12 weeks or more did not change the outcome significantly. But it's important to educate the patient so that they pursue the training and continue it at home. The benefit to COPD patients from pulmonary rehab are considerable. And it is the most effective therapeutic strategy to improve shortness of breath, health status, and exercise tolerance, which is an evidence A. So that's really one of the most crucial and one of the most underutilized or misutilized resources for patients. Vaccinations. We all know about, you know, the story, should we vaccinate or not, and what are the risks incurred after vaccination. But really, the data in the COPD population is very clear now. The influenza vaccine is very indicated, and it does improve the outcome, as well as the pneumococcal vaccines, whether, you know, the 23 or the 13. They both have a significant role in subsets of our patients, especially in the severe patient or the elderly. Well, of course, we can never forget smoking cessation, which can happen in so many different ways, as long as it works. I omitted, you know, some strategies, such as hypnosis, but if it works, I'll do it. So counseling, the magical 3 minutes. It was proven that if you speak with your patient for about 3 minutes, as negative as it seems to you or to the patient, there's a good chance that eventually they may stop smoking, or some of them would. Nicotine replacement work. We have to be very concerned or cautious with the use of e-cigarette, which is a form of nicotine replacement, because some patients use it as a substitute to smoking, not a way to stop smoking. And we're really unsure about its benefit and risks so far. And of course, we have the pharmacotherapy. Several medications are on the market, which did prove to have a benefit in terms of smoking cessation. And last, this subject is very dear to my heart. People who work with me know that, is palliative care. And this is where we as physicians have the biggest challenge in admitting that we kind of sealed our approach and we cannot push further into a curative way. We are all trained to cure people. We are the healers. But really helping the patient sometimes have a different approach. It's really about symptom management, alleviating the suffering, giving them a better quality of life at the end of their life. Not only for them, but for their loved ones, for their caregivers, for their family. And it is really, really underutilized. Studies have shown, even in the best centers who do have palliative care services in the States and in Europe, it is way, way underutilized. And most patients of COPD who die, who did get palliative care support, the palliative care service was only involved in the last 20 days of life, whereby over the past 6 months, the prior six months, the imminent end was kind of evident to the caregivers and to the family. And we know that even in patients with lung cancer, this is way more utilized than in COPD. So this is also more spelled and more clarified in this current guideline. And this is where I would like to leave you and thank you for being here.
So we have time for questions.
Thanks a lot. Two questions. I mean, regarding the one comment, oxygen therapy, I think, should be reevaluated after the patient being home. 2 to 4 weeks, there should be evaluated. Some of them, they can get rid of the following the exacerbation, I mean. The second, when do you start the pulmonary rehabilitation? The best time to start it?
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Samar. Well, the recommendation actually is after you initiate oxygen therapy, you would need to reevaluate the patient in 4 to 12 weeks afterward, as Dr. Samar was saying, just to confirm the persistent need. Because after exacerbation, you have a transient, you know, decrease in the lung function, which may improve gradually and regain a status where oxygen is no more needed. So, yes, correct. It has to be reevaluated in 4 to 12 weeks afterwards. Now, pulmonary rehabilitation. Really, the recommendation is to start them even early, even with a very functionally looking or seemingly functioning patient. It is actually an indication to consider it. But the moment that the quality of life becomes affected and you're starting to have, you know, a dyspnea score of 2, you would really be more forced to advance pulmonary rehabilitation. But it is advocated for all classes, really, and at different severity for all patients. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Salah. your comment on the device issue, because again, like you said, in westernized countries, they have people dedicated for that, because it makes sense. You have a nurse assistant, you have a PA, you have a pharmacist, you have your own secretary who's trained, and now we're bombarded by a plethora of devices, all claiming to be the best there is, and we have patients who actually jump from one to another. So a practical way of doing it instead of just making it theoretical, what would you suggest would be the best way, instead, except for you doing it in front of the patient and having the patient demonstrate on a placebo or maybe on a sample if you're lucky to have one? What would be the best approach to do this? Because I think this is a major problem, handicap to delivering of proper care.
Yeah, this point is, of course, very well taken. We all have the challenges of time and commitment in order to do that in the clinic settings, and some patients, you know, require more education than others and repetitive education. What I personally do, actually, I do have a set of samples and placebos in the clinic, so I do an original demonstration for all patients. And it would be clear to me if they kind of grasped it or not. The second step, I usually actually use digital and media support, such as YouTube.
Yes.
It's really a good resource. But of course, some patients also are not versed. Then you'll have to do the extra exercise. But I do use the media very much so, and especially the YouTube, to have, you know, like at least a reminder, if not a continuous education system.
How do you value hitting small airways in COPD according to the type of medicine which is inside the device and the type of devices that are numerous on the market?
Thank you, Dr. Khoury, for the question. The issue is, in my opinion, and in what I'm been looking for and reading, the issue of small airway disease in COPD, it's still somehow undermined compared to the asthma, for example, and we don't really have enough data to suggest that this is, you know, a strong indication to treat the small airways. So I think the data is still scarce about how to approach the small airways in COPD. There was data originally saying that, you know, the small airway surrogates and lung function, such as the FEF2575 that we used to look for, the mid-flows, do correlate with small airway disease, which evolves into COPD later on, but this never translated really into clinical scenarios. So, unfortunately, I'm not sure I can answer this question the way we should be answering it.
Thank you, Salah.
Thank you.